We asked almost 300 students this year to weigh the arguments for and against trigger warnings. Opponents arguing that trigger warnings inhibit intellectual freedoms, and proponents arguing that failing to use trigger warnings will re-victimize students who have experienced trauma and alienate them from the learning process. So ultimately, the question was to discuss the role trigger warnings play in higher education with respect to our nation's commitment to free speech. And we're really excited for you to hear from three of our essay winners today. So I'd like to ask all this year's winners joining us today to stand as I call their name. In second place for 11th and 12th grade, Savannah Williams, Brecksville Broadview Heights High School. In first place for 11th and 12th grade from Hathaway Brown, Isabella Nilsson. Our 9th and 10th grade winners, in third place, Jeffrey Gao, 10th grade Solon High School. In second place, Natalie Grace Sapula, 9th grade Andrews Osborne. And in first place, Isaiah Paik, 10th grade University School. So starting us off is the first place winner for 9th and 10th grade, Isaiah Paik of University School.
Before I begin, I'd like to offer a brief thanks to the late Hope and Stanley Adelstein, the City Club of Cleveland, all the facilitators for this contest, Ms. Faye Walker, my fellow competitors, all the judges, for making this contest possible and what it is today. Thank you. The Motion Picture Association of America, a trade association of six major Hollywood studios, has, since the late 90s, rated all films from G for general audiences to NC-17 for adults. Beyond the numbers and letters, the MPAA also shares the reasoning behind its ratings, citing violence or language or sexual content. The Entertainment Software Rating Board does the same for video games, and the Recording Industry Association of America places stickers and warnings on potentially offensive music. There are two important things to note. First, none of these associations or boards is a government agency. They are simply people who are fundamentally trying to protect others from harm. And second, none of these stickers or ratings is legally binding. Yes, some theaters may decide not to screen certain films for certain audiences, but fundamentally, every American still has a right to enjoy any media. We see this monitoring of entertainment as healthy and acceptable, not forceful suppressive censorship, but a warning to consumers of perhaps harmful parts of the product, delivered with a cautionary, not coddling tone. Trigger warnings do the same thing. While many opponents of this new trend see it as defacing of classical works or a product of hypersensitivity, as the Washington Post writes, the fact remains that trigger warnings don't restrict or harm or stop or disturb anyone. The whole idea of a warning is not a wall to stop you, but a sign on the side of the road advising you to proceed cautiously. Warnings of any kind put the power back into the hands of the individual, because we recognize that the best person to control the car is not the one at the wheel, not the people building roads or putting up signs. Just as nobody criticizes menus for warning that, say, eating undercooked fish or eggs or meat can increase the risk of illness or upset stomachs, and people can still order and enjoy their food rare, so too do trigger warnings allow consumers to be informed and forewarned and yet still proceed. Trigger warnings allow the reader or viewer or listener to know and anticipate what is coming and be ready, giving them back the power over their own state of mind that can be so heartlessly wrenched by traumatic material. They exist as a celebration of the fact that every individual is different, with, as Oberlin College puts it in its call to implement trigger warnings, lives before and outside your classroom, experiences you may not expect or understand. We need to accept that people may be deeply disturbed by certain triggers, and part of that acceptance is not to patronize or dismiss legitimate traumas. one Columbia University student, a survivor of sexual assault, was ignored and scorned by her professor for being traumatized by the graphic account of rape in Ovid's Metamorphosis. She reported disengaging from the class completely and feeling alone and ignored. Trigger warnings allow everybody to proceed with knowledge and caution and still perhaps enjoy a work, rather than be incapacitated and unable to learn and grow. Trigger warnings, which facilitate freedom and speech rather than suppressing art, ought to play a larger role in higher education. Colleges and universities represent, more than anything else in the world, the great melting pot of culture and backgrounds, all striving for the same pursuit of education. For this diversity of individuals to ignore triggers is to exclude parts of the population and their needs. In a world where 1 in 5 women is sexually assaulted, to not provide a warning for sensitive literature would be misogynistic and inconsiderate. This simple labeling would never limit free speech. Rather, by allowing people to be aware of potentially troublesome content, trigger warnings facilitate understanding and learning by allowing those who wish to proceed to do so, and those who don't to realize beforehand and be acknowledged. Beyond the false idea of censorship, opponents of trigger warnings make claims about infeasibility. Susanna Breslin, a sex blogger, described such warnings as the dream child of a fantasy in which the unknown can be labeled, anticipated, and controlled. What trigger warnings promise, protection, does not exist. The world is simply too chaotic, too out of control for every trigger to be anticipated, avoided, and diffused. To begin, this is a poor argument for why we should not implement trigger warnings, akin to saying that because we can never stop all crime, which is true, we should just give up and stop trying, which is ridiculous. Even if we can't stop every instance of harm, warnings can overwhelmingly do good. But moreover, this illusionary promise of a labeled world is what we strive for every day. Our movies, our music, our games, our roads, our swimming pools, even our meats are labeled and designated as potentially harmful and dangerous because we recognize that what does not pose a threat to one may be deeply devastating to countless others. But beyond that, we realize that the best way to protect everybody is not to restrict ourselves, but to alert us all to potential threats and harms so we, as the only ones who know our lives before and outside of the situation, can make educated choices and proceed or refrain. Only with adequate warnings can we truly be secure, because only then can we secure ourselves. These warnings, far from violating free speech, by labeling media as what they are, can actually facilitate better enjoyment and satisfaction. Thank you.
Thank you, Isaiah. Up next, Savannah Williams.
Trigger warnings and their place in higher education. Trigger warnings may seem like a good idea at first. A quick heads up when a sensitive topic like sexual assault, racism, or suicide is about to be discussed. When used effectively, trigger warnings help to prepare students affected by these issues to talk about them in a healthy educational way. But when the use of lack of trigger warnings put a teacher's job or a student's learning in jeopardy, there is a major problem. In 2014, students at the University of California at Santa Barbara passed a resolution asking that professors put trigger warnings on their syllabi and allow students to skip classes that may trigger the onset of symptoms of PTSD. According to another place of higher education, Oberlin College, these symptoms can be triggered by racism, classism, sexism, heterosexism, cissexism, ableism, and other issues of privilege or oppression, like depictions of suicide, sexual assault, or self-harm. As someone who has dealt with self-harm in the past, I would never skip a class that allowed me to express my feelings and get the word out about serious issues such as this. I'm happy to engage in discussion if it helps my fellow students understand the hardships that people like me face every day, and I refuse to hide this behind closed doors. I cannot solve my problems by running away from them, and neither can these college students. Discussion promotes healing, which is why talk therapy is so successful for survivors of sexual assault, self-harm, or other traumatic experiences. Expressing one's feelings is the first step to recovery, and pushing them down below the surface is two steps back. Trigger warnings are meant to prevent victims from reliving their experiences, but they can also give the uneducated an excuse to turn a blind eye. If we do not discuss these issues, we are condoning them. There's a difference between free speech and hate speech. The kind of texts that discuss sensitive issues are not hate speech. These texts are art, meant to provoke discussion, reveal deeper feelings, and serve as eye-openers to the world around us. Metamorphosis does not condone rape. The Perks of Being a Wallflower does not condone teenage drinking. And The Great Gatsby does not condone infidelity. Although these texts may describe offending material, it is not intended to be offensive. It is intended to provide thought-provoking and engaging discussion. If students require these trigger warnings on classic works of literature, then they will require these trigger warnings throughout their entire life. And the real world is not as accommodating as a college campus. And authors and artists have just as much of a right to express their thoughts and feelings on controversial topics as college students have a right to be offended by them. These students are well within their rights to speak their minds, but when their freedom of speech starts to infringe upon the other students' rights to an education, it is no longer protected under the First Amendment. In October 2015 at Yale University, a group of like-minded, trigger-happy students called for the removal of two administrators because they failed to speak out against offensive Halloween costumes, shouting, "It is not about creating an intellectual space, it's about creating a home." And, "I don't want to debate, I want to talk about my pain." This flies in the face of everything higher education stands for. College is a place for new experiences, challenging ideals, and the formation of new opinions. There's a reason it's referred to as higher education. A college-level education encourages critical thinking and high-concept ideas. The use of trigger warnings and the creation of safe spaces is a fantastic way to infringe upon one's own right to that kind of education. Students deserve to be challenged to debate and to question the world around them. One cannot learn if one covers their ears. When used effectively, trigger warnings can be a helpful tool in a classroom setting. They can prepare students for intense discussion and caution others to speak respectfully to their peers. But trigger warnings are not a weapon to be used to get out of class or avoid new perspectives. Hopefully, these warnings will be used on college campuses in the future as not a roadblock in the way of learning, but as an enhancement to higher education. Thank you.
Thank you, Savannah. And last but not least, our grand prize winner, Isabella Nilsson.
I'd also like to thank the late Mr. and Ms. Edelstein and everyone at the City Club, as well as everyone at my school, Hathaway Brown, and my mom. So I've been following the recent public discussion about the issue of trigger warnings and their impact on free speech with interest, and I feel that I am in some ways as qualified to weigh in as anyone. As a bisexual Latina female, I've been shocked and offended by callous statements classmates have made in texts I have read in class before. It was hard to read Jane Eyre, for instance, and not view Jane and Mr. Rochester's treatment of his Jamaican wife, Bertha, as cruel and offensive after finishing the companion novel and critique, The Wide Sargasso Sea. I'm a millennial born in an internet generation where any group, no matter how obscure and marginalized, can be found with a few swift keystrokes and a sure-footed search engine. And I am poised to begin college next year at Columbia University as an English major, where much of the national debate about trigger warnings and their place in the literary canon has taken place. Although I do not have the academic background or years of experience of some of the professors and experts that have inveighed upon and debated this issue, I feel in many ways that this is uniquely beneficial, since the entire system of trigger warnings, and I should clarify, I do not mean the trigger warnings veterans of PTSD and survivors of sexual assault request before viewing graphic material, but rather I use Oberlin College's recently predominant definition of anything that might cause trauma. And what they represent rests upon the foundation that every voice, no matter how young, inexperienced, or traditionally ignored, deserves to be listened to. This seems only just. What gives me pause are other logical leaps the trigger warning movement, if such a disparate collection of activists and ideas can rightfully be called such, both does and does not make. The assumption made, for example, that the demands of a single offended and frustrated voice are as important as that of an entire institutional body, or even as important as the ideal of open intellectual discussion itself, and that these demands must be adhered to and complied with under the looming threat of being labeled a bigot, which seems more and more often to be used as a tool for rhetorical compliance, rather than a person who hates or refuses to accept the members of a particular group as it is defined. I am also disappointed that advocates for trigger warnings seem to ignore the repercussions that leaving difficult books unread and challenging conversations unsaid could create. A culture less in tune and less empathetic to the unavoidable dark and difficult side of the world, and a generation so afraid to offend that they will not debate, and so zealous in the pursuit of total equality that actual mutual understanding and interaction is often ignored or smothered. Like many others, I followed the controversy surrounding Erica Christakis' email about Halloween costumes at Yale. I also watched the YouTube video capturing her husband and fellow academic Nicholas Christakis confronting a group of student activists calling for his resignation. To be frank, I found it difficult to watch. A young woman shouts at a renowned professor of over 20 years to be quiet. By sending out that email, that goes against your position as master. Do you understand that? This is a statement I cannot understand. Does acting as the steward of a dorm prevent a professor or their spouse from expressing their own, fairly tame, opinions? He tells her he does not agree. Then why did you accept the position? Who hired you? She screams, using a curse word twice. It's not about creating an intellectual space. It's not? Do you understand that? It's about creating a home. As someone only familiar with Yale's reputation as a global bastion of intellectual discussion and scientific advancement, I was unaware of such. And to say it strikes me as emblematic of the self-absorption student activists traditionally try to work against. Although I know that this video is only representative of a small part of radical student activism, I felt worried about applying to Yale after watching it, and I'm sure that were I a professor or student with differing views there, I would feel afraid to express them. In Professor Kate Mann's op-ed for the New York Times, Why I Use Trigger Warnings, she states that those affected by triggers may undergo panic attacks and feel disoriented, dizzy, and nauseated. It's about enabling everyone's rational engagement. In my own opinion, a student that becomes physically ill upon reading anything that offends them may need psychological help rather than a total censoring of anything that could possibly do so. As a reader, writer, and lover of literature, I also have issues with the idea of a trigger warning within the literary canon, as when Ovid's Metamorphoses was petitioned to be withdrawn as required reading at Columbia University due to scenes describing rape. Although I can certainly understand an individual asking a professor to be excused from reading a book due to a difficult past, the request for such a book to be removed from the syllabus entirely confuses me. No great literature is without darkness or confusion, because great literature reflects the world. Toni Morrison's Beloved, widely considered a triumph for feminist and racial understanding, is one of the most graphic books I have ever read. Violence and injustice is apparent when we turn on the radio, watch the news, or even consider our own pasts and futures. To reject reading a novel because it falls under Oberlin College's definition of a trigger as anything that causes trauma is not only to miss out on intellectual enrichment, but also to inculcate yourself against understanding the world. Neither life nor art can ever be universally happy or inoffensive. To expect such may be well-intentioned, but it is also short-sighted. Thank you.
That was outstanding, and I have no doubt that at some point we're going to be welcoming probably all three of you back here to deliver a forum at some point. Thank you very much. It was an honor to have you all participate in the contest, and you honored Stanley and Hope's memory in extremely high fashion by participating and performing as well as you did. Thank you.